Welcome to The Leading Tone, a podcast that explores all aspects of all types of music. Today, we discuss more of our favorite composers. I'm Fernando.
And I'm Alex, and welcome to The Leading Tone podcast. So, today we are doing the sequel to our first Top 100 Composers episode. If you haven't checked that out yet, that was the first episode we released. Basically, how the process works is that we both came up with our own list of Top 100 Composers. Kind of a futile exercise in itself, because you can't really rank these composers on their merit and their output numerically. However, we felt like we could in terms of our personal preferences. So what you're seeing today is this culmination of our two personal preferences averaged together. So we have these two lists that we both created, and we have representation from both on this list. So today we're talking about composers 11 through 20 on this list.
Yeah, these are just composers that we enjoy, and we're just going to give you kind of the reasons about why we enjoy them.
Right.
And not so much of the biography or anything. We'll save those for more detailed episodes where we explore maybe one or two composers at a time.
We'll try not to bog you down too much with the biographical information because we do have a lot written here, but we'll try not to get too ahead of ourselves, right?
Right.
It's pretty easy with these composers because we do love them so much. Well, with that, let's go ahead and get started.
Okay, let's start with number 11.
All right, number 11 is Sergei Prokofiev, Russian composer. Pretty firmly in the 20th century tradition, born in 1891, died in 1951. Now, Sergei Prokofiev was ranked number 23 on my list and number 4 on Fernando's. That might seem like a big jump, but I think that we mentioned in our first episode, probably up to number 25 on each of our lists, these composers have been our favorite composers at some point in time. So, really not that low for me. It could be different on any day. So I'll go ahead and kind of give some of my reasons for Prokofiev being where he is on my list. I think Prokofiev not only has a really interesting career, but he combines a lot of great Russian inspirations. And because of this, he might be one of the most diverse Russian composers, along with Rimsky-Korsakov, in terms of output, with a lot of inspirations from Russian greats. He studied with Rimsky-Korsakov, that's part of it, and also begrudgingly inspired by Stravinsky. He had a bit of a rough meeting with Stravinsky, but you could still see a lot of inspiration from Igor Stravinsky's music, as well as inspirations from Alexander Scriabin and Sergei Rachmaninoff. I mean, quite simply, he was a prodigy, and his prowess as a composer really can't be understated, and for that reason, he ranks number 23 on my list. Fernando?
Yeah, I just think that Prokofiev was such a prolific composer in so many different genres within, like, subgenres within classical music.
Right.
He was just so intelligent, and he really brought the full abilities to the front of a lot of these 20th century devices and even older devices. One of those is in the neoclassical style, which
right.
we enjoy so much in his classical symphony, which is his first symphony. But all of his symphonies I'm a really big fan of, especially 1, 2, and 7, and a little bit of 5. And that's what first got me into Prokofiev, but what really got me hooked was his ballet music, which we'll talk about a little bit in a second.
We just listened to some right before this.
Yeah, we did.
We had a great time with it. And some of the differences between the ballet interpretations and the orchestral interpretations, really interesting there.
Mm-hmm.
So I put this down for discussion because I guess this is only relevant for me. On my list, Prokofiev was lower than Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff, but on our average list, both Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff ended up in our top 10. For me, I think that, like I mentioned before, Prokofiev is a really, really great and intelligent Russian composer, but Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff, I feel like I can listen to a little bit less intelligently. I can listen to this when I study. I can listen to Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff, but I can't listen to Prokofiev when I study because his music is too too theory-based and too interesting for me, and I get distracted. So that's part of the reason why he's ranked a little bit lower for me.
But I think that's it's all up to taste, too, because for me, we were just talking about this before, too, when we were listening to some of the ballet music and some other pieces by Prokofiev. For me, I don't find it as, like, challenging, right. Like, mentally or aurally.
That's not representative of all of his works. Right.
Yeah, a lot of his stuff is really tuneful, but I do find it a little bit easier to, like, study to and to listen to casually, where I don't have to maybe listen to the whole thing, or I don't have to listen like super academically in an academic sense.
Mm-hmm.
I can just kind of listen to it casually. So it's personal taste, you know, and that's why he's so high for me, and why he's only a little bit lower for you.
Right. Yeah. And I will agree with you there, because there is a lot of his music that is quite tuneful. I think his First Symphony and his Fifth Symphony stand out as being very tuneful and really easy to get into. Then also some of his ballet music. But I will say, with some of his ballets, like his Romeo and Juliet, I'm such the kind of guy that needs to listen through something all the way through. And that's such a big commitment to listen to all of that music. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's a little bit harder for me, because definitely good airplane music, like we've mentioned before with Prokofiev, especially for some of this ballet stuff.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of fun things to know about Prokofiev. He began piano lessons at the age of 4, pretty solid there. His mother took him to a lot of great opera performances in his early years that inspired him, Glinka, Bizet, Borodin, and Verdi being performed. So you're starting to see early on in his career those inspirations. He went to school, but did not really like the conservatory lifestyle, was often very critical of his peers, despite the acclaim that they had for his unique compositions. Even though he was kind of a jerk in the way he went about it. But that doesn't diminish our love for Prokofiev.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting that he met Stravinsky, and it didn't go too well between the two of them. I thought that was an interesting little biographical tidbit. And then you also have Prokofiev as an avid chess player, even beating out some of the world chess champions at the time. So some cool facts about Sergei Prokofiev. Let's talk about a little bit more of some of his pieces, and then, for the first time on this podcast, do some listening.
Right, yeah. This time we have some public domain music and recordings that we've been able to find, and we'll be able to listen to those and talk a little bit about why we like those recordings.
Game changer, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's a big step. We were concerned about finding quality music samples, but we were able to find some.
Right, quality music we could use legally.
Yes. Ding, 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 right there.
Mm-hmm.
So, Fernando, you want to talk about some more of his pieces?
So the first thing that we're going to listen to today is Prokofiev's Piano Sonata Number 7, Opus 83, Movement 3. So let's take a listen to that. That was Prokofiev's Piano Sonata Number 7, Opus 83, Movement 3. And that, it sure is an energetic piece, right?
Yeah.
It is a little chaotic, a little bit almost random seeming for some people.
Right, to an untrained ear, definitely.
Right, but I think it's super funky. I think the left-hand part just really makes it groove a little bit.
Yeah, it's the left hand that gets me, too. I there's a lot of cool groove in there and some like dance-is kind of stuff that you would hear in like Bartok's Dance Suite or something. I really, really, really dig this.
Yeah, yeah, but a dangerous one to listen to in the car.
Yeah.
You know? You might drive a little bit too fast.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, a little bit crazy in that way.
Yeah.
But definitely, I think it's a good representative of Prokofiev's work, because it takes a lot of not only his virtuosity at piano. I don't know if we mentioned how virtuosic he is in terms of his piano playing and writing, but you see that in his orchestral music too.
Mm-hmm.
I think that his music is regarded as some of the most challenging Russian music and orchestral music in general. So with that, do you want to talk about some other recommendations for Prokofiev?
Yeah, some more pieces that we like by Prokofiev. He has 9 ballets, including Romeo and Juliet. I think that one's super accessible. We just watched quite a bit of that one earlier today.
It was definitely a new perspective watching that versus listening to it exclusively, because the orchestra has a lot different of interpretation usually if it's not with the ballet. So definitely worth checking out. We watched the full thing on YouTube.
Yeah, so. You can find the full thing on YouTube. So highly recommend that. And then he has 7 symphonies, at least, that are published, but he wrote 9.
Mm-hmm.
And our favorite of the symphonies is the Classical Symphony, which is his first symphony. But like I said before, I also like 2, 5, and 7, so you can check those out if you want to get a little bit deeper into it. And then he also wrote orchestral suites, music that was kind of reworked from other things or just for specifically to be a suite.
Yeah, Scythian suite specifically, because it was a reworking of the rejected Alla and Lolly score, which we'll talk a little bit more in depth if we do an episode on Prokofiev.
But right.
Really, really cool piece. Really aggressive music. So, definitely worth checking out. All right, Fernando, is there anything else on Sergei Prokofiev you want to mention?
No, I think I'm good. We can move on to number 12.
All right. Number 12 is Gustav Mahler, 1860 to 1911, late Romantic composer, ranked number 7 on my list and 24 on Fernando's. And this is one of my first great loves of orchestral music. Tchaikovsky was definitely my first, but then Mahler was second due to just the great, strong romantic symphonies, and his work has so much depth and heartfelt moments, as well as these beautiful, passionate climaxes. I just think Mahler is untouchable in terms of his gargantuan symphonic writing. I mean, there's not many composers that can do it for me like Mahler does in that sense. And also, I'm a brass player, so he's pretty significant in terms of his output for brass instruments, especially in the symphonic writing. Fernando, you want to mention some of your reasoning on Mahler? Not ranked as highly on your list, number 24.
Yeah, not as high on my list, but I do think that he's an absolute master of symphonies and of vocal music, and blending those two together, orchestral music and vocal music. I love how he does that. Kind of setting up vocal music in a new way for the time.
Right.
You know, doing an orchestral accompaniment with the vocal music.
Especially in that second symphony, yeah.
Right, yeah, and even just, like, vocal solos that were written originally for orchestral accompaniment. I think that's really a cool idea, and it was new.
Kinder Totenlieder.
Right, and like very new at the time. And I think he really did a lot for the symphonic form, making it a little bit longer, a little bit bigger of an orchestra.
Oh, yeah.
So, or quite a bit bigger of an orchestra for some pieces.
I mean, going off that tradition of Wagner and then Bruckner before him as well. And I think that those two definitely had an inspiration on his expansion of the symphonic form.
Yes, definitely.
For sure. The interesting discussion point here, because the philosophy and the literature influences on his music, I think those are actually two of the big reasons why I gravitate towards his music so much, because of those influences. He also had a very, very difficult life, as we mentioned in our first episode, but I think that those combined with his life experiences helped make his music incredibly personal, if a little bit sometimes overlong and overdeveloped in some cases, which I can admit to, but I think that there's something to be said by just his thoroughness and the depth that he puts into his symphonic writing. So definitely can get it on a tangent talking about Mahler's music in that way. Let's move on to some of his biographical information. Like I said, he had a tough childhood. Only out of 12 siblings, only 6 of them survived infancy. So kind of a sad beginning there, and that would shape a lot of his outlook on life. And then he began, just like Prokofiev, learning piano at the age of 4. So from an early age, was passionate about music. And like I said, studied with Bruckner. Not directly, but Bruckner was teaching at the Vienna Conservatory, and then Wagner was another one of his big influences. Lots of literary and philosophical influences, like we said, and conducting career pretty a famous one, starting in the Leipzig Opera and concluding with the New York Phil. Pretty strong conducting career there. Mm-hmm. I think either of us would be pretty happy with that.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Right. And then sadly, another tragedy with Mahler. Within a couple of months, his father, mother, and sister all passed away in 1889. And I think that this is relevant to mention, because I think that this was such a pivotal moment for Mahler and helped his music be as personal as it is, because he references these tragedies as being huge inspirations for his music to honor the loss of his loved ones. And I think that that is really important to note.
Yeah, and it's important also because in that same year, another important thing happened.
Right, yeah. So that same year was the premiere of his first symphony, The Titan, one of my favorites. Unfortunately, premiered to kind of lukewarm results. And in general, his works were not well received during his lifetime. So not only is Mahler having a pretty tough life, it wasn't until after he passed that a lot of the fruits of his work would be recognized. Bernstein, Leonard Bernstein, being the huge proponent of his music posthumously, because he promoted his music so hard, and some of the most iconic recordings of Bernstein's Mahler symphonies are available anywhere you can listen. Definitely worth checking those out. And so a couple more interesting facts about Mahler. He did play in the orchestra at the Vienna Conservatory, but was forced into the percussion section. We had this discussion because I guess at the time, percussion writing, especially in the orchestra, was not really that complex, that big. Mm. And so I guess if you were a piano player or something of that sort, and you were a composer at the Vienna Conservatory, and they're like, oh, well, we'll just put you in the percussion section. Mm-hmm. But I mean, now that couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, if you put me or Fernando in the percussion section right now, and we had to do more than play the bass drum, then right. We'd be
even
in trouble.
Even playing the bass drum. Even playing the bass drum could be very challenging in some more modern works.
And so there's one last thing I want to mention before we do some listening here. A symphony must be like the world. It must contain everything. A quote by Gustav Mahler, and I don't think that any quote could sum up his music better. Right, so we're going to take a listen here to one of Mahler's great symphonies, his fifth symphony. This won't be the beginning, it'll be a few minutes in, but we think that this is a good representation of Gustav Mahler's work. Let's take a listen to Mahler's Fifth Symphony. What a great work by Gustav Mahler. This is his fifth symphony, the first movement, the Trauermarsch. So, kind of sounds like the beginning here, but actually, this is about 5 minutes into the work, so if you're looking for this when you listen, it's a little bit later in the work. Yeah, I think that this one is significant for many reasons, not only being a really cool showcase of what he's done with the brass. here. But there's also all of these wildly different things going on in terms of orchestration. And this is only 5 minutes in to his Fifth Symphony. You have the strings doing their own thing with that line on top. And then you have solo trumpet, and then you have this low brass going underneath. And then in addition to some of the coolest horn excerpts in any symphony, I really, really, really love this excerpt. What do you think, Fernando?
I couldn't say it any better than that. That was a perfect summation or summary of this excerpt right here. And I think it's a fantastic excerpt for all the reasons you said. It really shows his great orchestration, I think. Mahler's great orchestration is completely on display in this excerpt alone.
Yeah, because it's not like Sibelius or Vaughan Williams where it's really transparent. There's so much going on here, but you can find enjoyment in each one of these parts, especially for us listening to this a little bit more with a trained ear. We're really picking out these small little things that Mahler puts in there. It's like, that's an interesting choice there that he did in orchestration. So definitely really cool.
And I would challenge anybody that is really interested in getting into it a little bit deeper to kind of listen for one instrument at a time. You know, go back and listen to that a couple times.
That's always a cool exercise.
Yeah, and you'll hear something completely different and something that might surprise you within just one instrument line, because it jumps out and then it'll kind of go back into the shadows.
But
they'll still be
playing.
Yeah, exactly. They're still playing, and it'll be something that's really, you know, just not brought to the forefront, but really still important.
And it's the expertise of the orchestra in that sense, too.
Yeah, I recently watched a video. I don't remember whose it was, but they said that the key to orchestration is that if you took away one of the things, even though if it doesn't seem like it's super important, if you took it away and it still the piece felt incomplete, then that's good orchestration.
Right.
Because it's a minor detail.
Yeah.
But with it, it adds to it. It's significant, and if you take it away, then it feels empty and not as good.
Absolutely.
So that really applies here to this excerpt and to all of Mahler's work.
Right, and Mahler's work we probably mentioned already. Most of his work is incredibly long for the symphonic form. I mean, I think that he has some of the longest symphonies. So definitely a cool fact about Mahler there. So we just listened to his Fifth Symphony. Let's mention some of our other recommendations. For me, I started with the Titan, his first symphony, and I talked about that earlier. Great work there. The Resurrection, his second symphony, is the one I've seen live. That was a truly religious experience, no pun intended there. But I really, really love that work. And then his Fifth Symphony is famous for that opening with the trumpet solo, as well as that beautiful fourth movement, the Adagietto. Right, I feel like that's featured a lot in a lot of different mediums, and I've definitely heard it in some commercial somewhere, too. Then his sixth is an underrated one to most, his Tragic Symphony. In a letter to Webern, composer Berg writes, "There is only one sixth, despite the pastoral." Kind of a bold statement there. There's a lot of great sixth symphonies out there, but Mahler's, to me, stands out as being one of the most passionate and the most dramatic of all of his symphonic works. Really, really great symphonic writing there. And so there's a couple others that are written off a little bit. His Third Symphony and his Seventh Symphony are both really, really great works there. And Das Lied von Erd and Kinder Totenlieder, some of his works that involve a little bit more of the voice. Fernando, do you have any... I know I kind of stole the show on Mahler. Do you have anything else to discuss with Mahler?
No, I think that's really good.
All right, sounds good. Well, let's go ahead and move on then to one of Fernando's favorites, Béla Bartók, Hungarian composer from 1881 to 1945, pretty firmly in the 20th century, ranked number 30 on my list and number 3 on Fernando's. And if I could do my list over, I would probably have Bartók a little bit higher, because I recently found some really cool works by Bartók that I hadn't heard before, like his dance suite that I was really, really into. Fernando, you want to talk about why you love Bartók so much?
Yeah, so the reason why Bartók is so high on my list is because of the blending of his ethnomusicological studies and his studies in music theory, I think those two things came together in this perfect way where that only Bartok could have done. And he has these crazy and unique harmonies and rhythms that it inspired an entirely new way of analysis to be formed. And when that's called axis theory. We can get into that in a later episode if
yeah, that might be a little much to talk about today.
Yeah, it might be. Basically, it's just about breaking away from the typical functional harmony and using these substitutions for the tonic, dominant, subdominant. If that's foreign to you, don't worry about it.
But, yeah, but for us theory buffs, that's kind of a big deal in orchestral music, I think.
Right, and those are just some of the reasons why I like Bartok.
Absolutely. Yeah, so for me, Bartok, though he's not ranked as high comparatively, and if I was to redo this in retrospect, I'd probably have him 5 to 10 places higher just after discovering his dance suite. And of course, I've always loved his Concerto for Orchestra, really, really creative work there. They're just so sophisticated and so bold, mm-hmm. I think, in terms of orchestral style. I don't think you hear a lot like it. I compare it to Hindemith sometimes. Mm-hmm. Hindemith, I think, is a good comparison with Bartok, though maybe not as tuneful as Bartok. I think of his music in that sophisticated orchestral vein there.
Well, that's why I'd like to say that Bartok's music, a lot of it can be very, very tuneful, and that's why it's so appealing to me.
Right, because it's also incredibly intelligently done,
right,
in addition to being tuneful.
Right, exactly. And so I think that's where, if you were to try to get into Bartok, you have to start with some of the more tuneful ones, but we'll get into those in a little bit. Let's start with the discussion here.
Yeah, this discussion is interesting because there's a couple of influences in here, most notably Kodály.
Right.
Zoltán Kodály was a big influence on Bartok, and they traveled together gathering this huge collection of folk music. I think, yeah, over 6,000 recordings. But in addition to that, he has influences from Franz Liszt, Richard Strauss, Debussy, Brahms, Stravinsky, Schoenberg, in addition to Kodály, so pretty broad spectrum there. A couple of 20th century composers that you can definitely see had a big influence in, especially some of his later writing with some of his more serialist music.
Yeah, and so it's really interesting to see how those influences, those Romantic period and early 20th century influences, interacted and started to blend with his studies in ethnomusicology.
Because it created this unique voice for him that's so unlike a lot of composers, particularly in the time. To give you a little bit more background with Bartok, some of his first compositions were before the age of 10, and he was offered a spot in the Academy of Music in Vienna, but actually opted for the Royal Hungarian Academy of Music. This is really critical because this would lead him to discover his ethnomusicological influences.
Yeah, and that's because he was still staying in Hungary, and it enabled him to learn more about the Hungarian and Eastern European folk music,
right,
which he wouldn't have gotten in Vienna if he had chosen to study there.
In terms of his music, I mean, his dance suite and Concerto for Orchestra, chock full of some of those tunes, for sure. And then, we mentioned before he traveled all around with Kodály to record all of these folk songs on a phonograph, carrying around that phonograph all over Eastern Europe. Some other fun facts, taught Fritz Reiner and George Solti piano. So pretty big deal there. That Reiner recording with the Chicago Symphony of Concerto for Orchestra and the Music for Strings, Percussion, and Celeste, and also his Hungarian Sketches here. Really, really great album there. So definitely worth checking out. So before we jump into some of his pieces, should we listen?
Yes, let's take a listen. What do we have up next for us?
We have Allegro Barbaro, the solo piano version, not the orchestral or wind band versions that are also popular. Allegro Barbaro by Béla Bartók. Let's take a listen.
Thank you.
Okay, that was a snippet of Allegro Barbaro by Bartok, and another really high energy piano piece,
right.
Similar
one.
to similar to Prokofiev's really high energy one. So
it's
I guess it's a little bit
more different than some of his folksier offerings.
I think it's very different compared to some other things like what we've mentioned before, the dance suite, Hungarian sketches, things like that. But definitely high energy and something that you can really grab onto. It doesn't bore you in any way, for sure. It's another one you probably shouldn't drive to.
I couldn't imagine being bored listening to this. I mean, and particularly in this recording, I think that he takes some interesting liberties here in terms of some rubato actually kind of speeding up and slowing down that I don't know if I normally hear that during some of his like the wind band recording.
That's easier to do as one person.
Right. Very, very true. But definitely really, really cool music here, and shows you some of the diversity of Bartok's output, because it wasn't all folksy stuff. There's definitely some more aggressive and some more complicated things harmonically, right? I mean, this alone, I think, is pretty complex harmonically. I mean, it's not challenging in a way to listen to, but I think it is a little bit more dense than people would realize. If you did analysis of this, it'd be like, oh, that's that chord, really?
Yeah.
So I think that is... That is something to think about with Bartok. He has a pretty wide output in terms of what he's done, because for the stage, he wrote Bluebeard's Castle and The Miraculous Mandarin, which I would say are a little bit more in this vein, right? Allegro Barbaro.
Yeah.
But those are a little bit more out there. But I think that they kind of come from a similar place in terms of think space. I would say so, at least.
Yeah.
And then he had a lot of piano works. He was a great piano player, string quartets, and then Allegro Barbaro, like we've played. So definitely some really diverse output from Bartok.
Yeah, and we can't ignore the piano concerti either, and the concerto for violin and a concerto for viola.
Right.
But the piano concerti are very hard and also very interesting to listen to. So those are really fun ones. And did we mention his choral music?
I didn't think I mentioned that.
Yeah, so he has a little bit of that as well. So a lot of good stuff to check out. Of course, like we said, his most iconic stuff or his most iconic piece is Concerto for Orchestra. But once you get past that, I think there's even more wonderful listening ahead.
Right, absolutely. I think that Bartok is definitely earning a spot on our list, for sure. Let's move on to Percy Grainger, Australian composer, 1882 to 1961, another 20th century composer. I put folk 20th century here, while I only put 20th century for Bartok. Maybe it would have been appropriate to put folk as well for him. But I think that there's something to be said between Grainger's music being a little bit more folksy throughout his career, where Bartok maybe moved away from that.
I think it's more appropriate for Grainger because he specifically did arrangements of folk song settings.
Right.
And I think that's where Bartok didn't do as much specifically just a folk song setting. He would do more of an incorporation into something else.
Right. So why would you say you have Grainger ranked where you have him? You have him ranked number 16 and I have him ranked number 18.
Well, I really do like Grainger's music, and that's obviously the first criteria, right? The criterion. Yeah, I really love Grainger's unique language and all of the devices that he uses. Some people call them Grainger-isms.
Yeah, we hear that a lot at school.
Yeah, and that's always a fun little term, and all of his little quirks are quite fun. And it gives it a really characteristic style and sound.
Yeah.
So I really like that about his music, and that distinct style and sound, you can really tell that it was influenced by his biography a little bit, like a lot of the biographical information influenced his music.
He's so well documented too,
in his own museum.
Yeah, exactly, in his own museum.
when that was around. Yeah,
maybe a little too well documented in some cases.
Yeah,
well, for me, I think Grainger is a pretty eclectic mix of ethnomusicology and imagination.
Right
I think that is pretty big in terms of when you're talking about Grainger. You're not only talking about the folk music, but you're also talking about how he was a little bit ahead of its time in terms of experimentation, especially in his early career. I mean, he even gave a early shot at chance music, which wouldn't become popularized in the academic music world until much later.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that Granger's music does stick out, though, definitely as being a little bit more personal because there's so much information about him and we know so much about him that his music takes on that character of his strange quirks and some of his other biographical information. I think that his music definitely takes on that character.
So let's get into some of that biographical information. Right. Granger was born in Melbourne, Australia. And then later, he moved to Frankfurt, Germany at the age of 13 with his mother to study. He withdrew from his formal composition lessons with Yvon Noor to study with Karl Klimsch, a proponent of folk music, helping to spark his lifelong interest in the topic. In 1905, he began to collect folk songs in England with a phonograph. So
he started to get the material for his famous Lincolnshire Posy.
Right, exactly. Do you want to expand on that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I did a really long presentation in my wind literature course in undergrad on Granger's Lincolnshire Posy, and it ended up being like about an hour and a half of a presentation. So I could talk about it for a long time, but to give you kind of the cliff notes for Lincolnshire Posy, he went all around the English countryside and was recording, just like Bartok, recording these folk songs at the phonograph. So he gets all these, and then one of them in particular, funny story, he actually hears this man sing a folk song the year before, and he doesn't have his phonograph, and he's like, I gotta come back. So he comes back a year later. This man is unfortunately in the hospital, and he's laying there in the bed, and Granger's like, hey, will you sing this for me? This man, he has a concussion, this man, and Granger's there at his bedside asking him to sing. So there's this recording on YouTube of all of these phonograph recordings of the songs he uses for Lincolnshire Posy, and then one of them is this man who is in a hospital bed with a concussion.
Mm-hmm.
So Granger would stop at nothing to get the music that he wanted.
Yeah, and if you're familiar with Lincolnshire Posy already, then obviously you should definitely check those out. It gives a great background and context to the piece itself.
Right.
So moving on a little bit in his biography, in 1906, he meets Edvard Grieg, who we talked about their relationship in the previous episode, in episode 3, about Nordic composers.
Right.
So check that one out if you're curious about that. In 1917, he joins the U.S. Army as a bandsman. So at this point, he's living in the U.S.
Right.
And in the Army band, he plays oboe and saxophone, which he considers to be the instrument closest to the human voice. So that's specific to saxophone.
Right, yeah. And that was really characteristic of his compositions, I think. Mm-hmm. that he used a lot of saxophone, and he used it in that way, and in this very lyrical way. So definitely can see that there. So predating us by nearly 70 years, Granger devises a ranking system for composers based off of complexity and artistry of music, ranking himself the 9th best composer of all time. While our list isn't necessarily based off of artistry and complexity, more so our personal tastes, Granger goes ahead and makes this list and makes himself the 9th best composer of all time, ahead of Tchaikovsky and Mozart. So he's not being humble in any way here. He is very clear that, yeah, I'm the 9th best composer of all time,
mm-hmm.
casually.
but he was not bold enough to put himself ahead of Bach.
And Dalius, too.
Or Dalius, who is a much lesser-known composer than Tchaikovsky and Mozart now, but apparently...
He loved Dalius' music, though. Yeah. He added a lot of inspiration from Dalius, for sure.
Apparently a big fan, Granger was. So let's go on to his music a little bit.
Yes.
Let's see. We do have a clip of a movement from Lincolnshire Posy, The Brisk Young Sailor, which is the 4th movement of this work for wind band. So let's take a listen to that.
Thank you.
What a tuneful work by Percy Grainger. That was movement 4 of Lincolnshire Posy, The Brisk Young Sailor.
Right. Really, really great work here. I think that when we're listening to this, we sing the backgrounds more than we do the melody, because we know this piece so well, and we're just sitting here singing these arpeggiated euphonium and bassoon licks. Like, I think that they're some of the most demanding background works ever written for the wind band, specifically.
Most definitely. And Percy Grainger has so many wind band works that we're so familiar with from playing in those types of ensembles.
Right. I think we played almost all of these on the list.
Yeah, so just a few of those. Let's go ahead and list some of those off. We've got, like we said, Lincolnshire Posy, Irish Tune from County Derry, Molly on the Shore, Country Gardens, Colonial Song, Children's March, The Immovable Doe. Well, now we're getting into some orchestral territory here, too. In a nutshell suite, The Warriors, which is the orchestral work, Handel in the Strand, and Harvest Hymn.
Right, so huge amount just from that list. We omitted so many works from this list, and those were just some of his most popular ones. But Lincolnshire Posy, I think, is a good starting point, and especially The Brisk Young Sailor, I think, is a good representation of some of his folk music with a little bit more of that complexity and harmonic ambiguity. We could have played the Rufford Park Poachers, which might have scared some people away if they're listening to Grainger for the first time.
But right.
That one's a little bit more challenging to the ear.
So this is a staple in the wind band community. And so if you're currently in that, maybe you're in middle school, high school, college, or if you're a band director as well, this would obviously be required listening.
Right, absolutely.
But if you're not, it's also just a really fun piece to hear with a different type of ensemble. We talk about a lot of orchestral music, so
Something a little bit different. Our first wind band composer we're going to be discussing actually on this list. I think that Persichetti won't be until the next episode, so cool thing there.
All right, I think we're moving on.
Right, Fernando, you take the lead on our number 15 composer.
All right, so number 15, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. He was an Austrian composer in the 18th century, 1756 to 1791. Fits very nicely into the classical period of music.
Very neatly.
Yeah, into the classical period. Different than classical music, it's specific to a certain time period that Mozart is really well known in. But anyways, he is number 19 on Alex's list and number 20 on my own.
Pretty close.
Yeah. And recently, just from doing this research, I think maybe I would have even moved them up higher. But
I would agree too.
But let's talk a little bit about him. Why do I like Mozart? Well, I think he's just a master of that classical period style. And I love his great sense of humor that is just so apparent in a lot of his music and is so often ignored by a lot of people that play Mozart. A lot of people take it much too seriously.
Like, I'm playing Mozart. Okay.
Right. For such a silly guy. But yeah. I guess you'll hear a little bit about that when we get into some of his biographical information. But,
right. He's just a funny dude, honestly.
Right. So what are the things that make you like Mozart, and why is he number 19 on your list, Alex?
Well, I mean, I put it really simply here. I think he's just really easy to approach, and I can listen to his music both intelligently and casually. And you hear me mention those terms a lot, because I think that is something that's important to think about, at least in my rationale, because some composers I really, really love, but maybe put them a little bit lower on the list because I don't get to them as often, because I really need to think and listen to them. And for anyone who commutes a lot, like Fernando and I do, we find most of our listening to be in the car.
Right.
So I think that Mozart I can listen to anywhere.
Right. So with that being said, how often would you say you listen to Mozart's music?
Well, I'm always going to say not enough.
Right.
But I would say I have a phase every couple of months where I find something on Spotify's Discover Weekly and I'm just like, oh, what is this? And then it's Mozart. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is just such a beautiful work of classic literature. And then I jump down the rabbit hole and I am only listening to Mozart for that week. So probably maybe a little bit less so than you do, but I did have a pretty great experience the last two summers getting to visit his birthplace and his residence in Salzburg, and that had such a profound effect on me. So I think since then, he's definitely moved up on my list, definitely worthy of being in the top 20 for sure. And I think that his influence just can't be denied, but I'm getting away from myself a little bit here. How often would you say you listen to his music?
Well, for myself, I'd say probably at least once a month, maybe even more frequently than that.
Right.
And it always just ends up being, like you said, kind of random. It just kind of pops into my recommendations, or I just happen to pass it by. It's relatively high on my playlist of hundreds and hundreds of works, but it's relatively up there just in the way that I ended up setting it up. So it definitely comes into my rotation quite a bit, and I really always enjoy it when it comes up. And it's so refreshing to have that be mixed in with a lot of 20th century music, because it's a huge change of pace and brings a little bit of lightness.
So like we said, born in Salzburg, a son of Leopold Mozart, also a composer. As far as was known, Leopold was actually entirely responsible for the education of all of his children, which included music as well as math, reading, writing, literature. So Mozart was definitely well educated. By the age of 4, he had already learned to play the keyboard. So another composer, age 4 seems to be the year where it's just all these serious composers. All right. gonna just become a prodigy now.
Right, and he wasn't just, you know, starting to learn piano. He was already playing minuets that were anonymous and other binary form works, as well as works by his own father and by C.P.E. Bach. So
I was playing Game Boy when I was 4.
Right. Right. So that's no joke. He's really already at that point showing a bit of being a prodigy, I suppose.
Right. So Fernando, do you want to talk about Mozart and how a little bit later in his life, by age 13, what he was up to?
Yeah, so by age 13, he had achieved this significant local reputation in Salzburg as both a composer and a performer. And on October 27th of 1769, he was appointed on an honorary basis as concertmaster at the Salzburg court, which is a really significant position.
13.
Yeah, at 13. That's already quite impressive. At the court, he preferred to write more secular and instrumental music, but they really wanted him to do a bit more of the sacred music. By the end of 1781, he had established himself as the finest keyboard player in Vienna. This is after leaving the court in Salzburg. And the only person that really seriously contested him was Clementi, another keyboard player in Vienna. Those are the only two that were really very prominent at the time. Look who has lasted over time. I think most people are very aware of Mozart. So yeah, those are all of Mozart's main jobs that happened in the over his lifetime, with a lot in between. And I really want to do a Mozart episode. I think that'll be really fun if we end up getting to do that. If you're really interested in that, let us know. But we might just do it anyways, because I'm really interested.
Yeah, and all the information we have on Mozart here.
Right.
Fernando typed like 6 or 7 pages on Mozart. So.
Right. So just a little bit more here, just to give a kind of a context to his music. Unlike Haydn, who was older than him by 24 years, and unlike Beethoven, who was younger than him by 15, he attempted actually most of the art music forms, that is to say string quartets and concerti and symphonies and all of these different things. He attempted most of these forms in his time, and he excelled at really all of them. They were all accepted and thought of well during his lifetime.
Right.
So that's different than a lot of composers during his time or around his time that are still well known today.
Or even Mahler later, we talked about earlier. I mean.
Yeah. So let's get into some facts. So once Mozart was on his own, his finances weren't really stable. He had a tough time balancing the budget. Him and his wife were not the best at balancing the budget in that way, and maybe that's why he composed so much, just trying to get a lot of money from
doing that. Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's fair.
So this is one of my favorite fun facts. I think this one's really funny. At age 6, Mozart actually met Marie Antoinette, who was at the time Archduchess, but later Queen of France, and she was only 2 months older than Mozart. And so it's said that Mozart slipped one time when they were in the same area, and she helped him up. And so in return, Mozart proposed marriage to the Queen of France, or Archduchess at the time, but the person...
Can we please have that alternate version of history where...
Yeah, exactly. Could you imagine the King of France, Mozart, with Marie Antoinette?
Right.
Let them eat cake, right? So...
I love it. Oh, and this next story here, this is... So the reason why we're talking about so much of Mozart's story and these funny little things is we do think that it is huge in not only characterizing him as a person, but as a composer. He has so many of these little splashes of humor in his music. And this next story definitely takes the cake for the best Mozart story, in our opinion.
Yes, perfectly contextualizes why his music can be so humorous. So, Mozart had a pet bird, specifically a starling, as well as a dog, but we're going to really dive into the bird in this situation here. So, a theme from his piano concerto number 17 in G is nearly identical to a melody that Mozart transcribed from one of the tunes that he taught the bird. So he taught this bird how to sing, supposedly, in the pet shop, and he said, wow, this is so amazing. So he brought the bird back home and kept him as a pet.
We need to get ourselves a friend like Mozart's bird.
Yeah. And so when the bird, the starling, unfortunately passed away, Mozart had a whole funeral procession for the bird, in which everyone was heavily veiled, and those that were capable of singing were required to sing hymns. And he also wrote an entire poem, now translated and available online, which we're going to read in a second. But he wrote an entire poem for the event, and he included a headstone in his garden where his bird was buried. All very sweet things, but a little bit extreme for a pet bird. I mean, I know a lot of people get attached to their pets, and I might do the same thing if I was so attached like Mozart was.
Right.
So let's get into the poem really quick. So Mozart's poem, translated by Robert Spaethling into modern English. Here it is right here. Here rests a bird called Starling, a foolish little darling. He was still in his prime when he ran out of time, and my sweet little friend came to a bitter end, creating a terrible smart deep in my heart. Gentle reader, shed a tear, for he was dear, sometimes a bit too jolly, and at times quite folly, but nevermore a bore. I bet he is now up on high, praising my friendship to the sky, which I render without tender, for when he took his sudden leave, which brought to me such grief, he was not thinking of the man who writes in rhymes as no one can.
So wait, you're telling me that this is not the plot of an episode of The Office. This is Mozart and his bird.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. This is Mozart and his little pet bird. And I just like the last line here. Sounds like he's a rapper who writes and rhymes as no one can.
It's like that video, it's like, I'm going to end this whole man's career. That's that line right there.
Right. So that's just a little bit of Mozart's love for animals and also just a little bit of his humor. I think he was very attached to this bird, but also was doing it a little tongue-in-cheek as well.
Right.
And you can tell that in the poem a little
exactly.
bit.
Exactly. So let's get into listening some of Mozart's music and showing off some of that humor. This is an excerpt from his Symphony No. 29, the first movement. Let's take a listen to some Mozart.
That was the first movement of Mozart's 29th symphony. And to contextualize that a little bit, here's a quote from Leonard Bernstein. Bernstein said that Mozart's works were bathed in a glitter that could have come only from the 18th century, from that age of light, lightness, enlightenment. Over it all hovers a greater spirit that is Mozart's. The spirit of compassion, of universal love, even of suffering. A spirit that knows no age, that belongs to all ages. I think that's completely true, and it has that lightness, that springiness, but that elegance, right? And
right. It
just feels so timeless. A lot of people might listen to this and think, oh, that sounds so dated, and it sounds very obviously in the classical period. But if you get into the analysis, if you go a little bit deeper, I think
right. You
really do hear some things that are that have stood the test of time,
absolutely.
Even into classical music.
Absolutely. I would
totally
agree.
Into popular music.
Right, right. I think that the reason why we have spent so much time talking about Mozart is because of his great influence, but the spirit and the compassion and the love that is exuded from Mozart's music, I mean, not only to speak of his humor like we have been, but I think that all of those things are definitely reflected in this work and a lot of his other great symphonic works, like his 25th, 40th symphonies, his Requiem, and lots of works for the stage. Just a lot to dive into with Mozart, wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. And that those are all the works that we would recommend.
Yeah.
Over 50 symphonies, only 41 numbered, though. Like you said, the Requiem, some Concerti, and a lot of music for the stage. Some that you might be familiar with, The Marriage of Figaro, Don Giovanni, Così fan tutte, Die Zauberflute, which is the magic flute. All of those are excellent works, and
absolutely,
we totally recommend those.
Definitely. Well, I think we've spent enough time on Mozart, Fernando. What do you say we move on to number 16 on our list?
Number 16. Who is it?
Oh, it's Aaron Copland, American composer, 1900 to 1990. Super easy to remember those dates. I'd say he fits pretty firmly into the 20th century.
Yeah, I would say
by
so.
By dates alone, but especially with his music we'll talk about. Ranked number 8 on my list and 32 on Fernando's. Now, I went a little bit more in depth with my rationale on Copland because I think that Copland is super interesting when it comes to influences, because you have these French influences from Debussy, Ravel, Satie, and his teacher, Nadia Boulanger. Then you have influences from Mio, Poulenc, Webern, Berg, Bartok, Stravinsky, who is actually his favorite. As well as the genres of jazz and ragtime. And also, he has this subliminal influence from actually being a student of Dvorak, which is a dream come true combination for a composer for me. Not only do you have Dvorak, but you have all these other influences here. I think that his music is just so unique in terms of listening experience and really quite eclectic. I think that you could argue that his music isn't necessarily American due to his influences. I think it's more representative of the melting pot that has become America. America is such a melting pot in terms of influences and people that have moved here. And I mean, like, it's, I think that you can argue that his music isn't American in this way. I think that his music is pretty international, so to speak.
Most definitely, yeah. For myself, I think it's actually really obvious that Stravinsky was such a big influence on Copland.
Depends on where you listen, though.
Yeah, it does depend on where you listen. But you kind of see Copland take this similar career path where he goes from really like popular styles to more serial styles.
Right.
And Stravinsky did a similar thing in a lot of his works, but that's for another day or another discussion. My favorite compositions, though, by Copland are ones that just have catchier tunes and simpler harmonies. I'm not as big of a fan of those serial works by Copland, but that's just my personal taste. Those catchy tunes and simpler harmonies that I like can definitely be heard in Appalachian Spring, Rodeo, and Lincoln Portrait.
Right, and those are some of your favorites by Copland. Then some of my favorites are his Symphony for Organ and Orchestra, or his Third Symphony. So it's so cool that we can both really enjoy this composer for completely different eras in his music. So, like a lot of composers on this list, he received his first piano lessons pretty early on, actually from his sister. This was actually not until his early teens, though, so not quite Prokofiev or Mahler at the age of 4. By 1917, he's taken harmony and composition lessons from a former student of Dvorak, Ruben Goldmark, who is also the nephew of composer Carl Goldmark. So, cool family tree there. Then, like we said, Copland's admiration for the French greats was huge. He went to go study with Nadia Boulanger, who's nicknamed the One Woman Graduate School. You're going to hear us reference her a lot throughout many of our composer episodes. And then throughout the 30s and 40s, he's adopting this more sophisticated approach to composition. And he's quoted as saying, "I was trying to write music in the serious field, which would be as American in quality as the jazz boys had been able to manage in the light field." So I think that quote is pretty perfect to sum up the majority of his music, because he does have some of those jazzier and ragtime influences there. However, Copland is trying to make something completely original and American. And in a way, he ends up just taking from all of these other influences from around the world. And
just like America does too, though.
Exactly.
That is the American culture, I would
say.
So
I guess his music does embody the American spirit in that way.
The melting pot of music, I suppose.
So he taught some famous composers, Leonard Bernstein, Alberto Ginastera, Samuel Adler, and Michael Tilson Thomas.
Yeah, famous composers and conductors in there, too.
Absolutely. Let's take a listen to some Copland, is what we would say if we had some listening.
Got my hopes up.
Unfortunately, we couldn't find any listening for Copland in public domain that was up to the quality that we wanted to present to the audience. So unfortunately, we have no listening for Copland today. But we will talk a little bit more about some of his works to give you an idea of where to start with him. I've mentioned his Symphony for Organ and Orchestra. Fernando has mentioned Rodeo already. The four dance episodes from Rodeo are a great example of some of his more yee-haw type of writing. A little bit more pastoral in terms of harmonies, and definitely embodies the spirit of various regions of America. With Rodeo, it's obviously the West, right? Yeah. The Wild West.
And if you're looking for something exciting, listen to Hoedown from that work.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, the Hoedown is something that's very exciting, and it'll get you going in the morning if you like that kind of music.
And I want to mention his Third Symphony, written in 1946, because that is one that's really resonated with me. In 1942, he wrote his Fanfare for the Common Man, which some themes in the symphony were based off of. Fernando, you've already talked about Appalachian Spring, but I think that's one of your favorites, and it won a Pulitzer Prize too.
Yeah, that one is definitely one of my favorites. Featured a lot in a lot of wind band rep, and also in drum corps too. You
marching
hear it in a little bit of
drum corps,
marching band. Yeah, but I enjoy that work on its own as well. And Lincoln Portrait is also another big one for me.
Right.
That one is unique because it has a narrator, and you don't get to hear that a lot. Narration.
Yeah.
With
I think that one's
music.
Just cool by itself, too, even without the narration. I think that there's some really cool music in there.
Yeah.
And then there's also works like Emblems for Wind Band. There's Tenderland for Stage. And then this new one I discovered, the 12 Poems of Emily Dickinson, or 8 poems, depending on whether you listen for piano and voice and for orchestra and voice. Really cool if you're interested in the poems of Emily Dickinson. So definitely worth checking out. And like I said earlier, unfortunately, we don't have any listening for Copland. Fernando, is there anything else you want to talk about with Aaron Copland?
Nope. I think that's good. Just check out some of those recordings if you're interested in some American music by Copland.
All right. Sounds good. Let's move on to Maurice Ravel, number 17. I put down modern impressionist, but he actually did not like the term impressionist. He thought that diminished the value of his music, actually. So interesting there. I had him ranked number 22 and Fernando number 18. So pretty close in terms of our ranking. I think Fernando is the one that really actually opened my eyes to Ravel, because everyone knows his famous orchestration of Pictures at an Exhibition by Modeste Mussorgsky.
Well, not everybody knows that that's his orchestration.
I think that's also true. They're like, oh, who's this Ravel guy? But with Ravel, I mean, he really has this really interesting biographical information, but also really stimulating compositions that result in this unique mixture of voices, from kind of this French nationalism to dance music to neoclassicism, Baroque music, jazz music, classical music. You've got all of it in there. I think that because his music is such a marriage of all of these different styles, it becomes this amorphous thing that it's really hard for me to define. And that was why I had such a hard time defining him as a composer. I think that that's what draws me to him so much. It's this eclecticism that really excites me when I listen, or when I just like look at a score, I'm just like, wow, this is so incredibly interesting. And Fernando, I'm assuming your rationale is pretty similar to mine. You want to speak on that a little bit?
Yeah, it's incredibly similar to yours. I, of course, love his well-known abilities in orchestration, and I really love his knowledge in theory as well, in music theory. Like you said, he incorporated all these different styles, but he did it in this academic way that actually led to the faculty at the Paris Conservatory to not really like him that much.
And it led to this whole stink a little bit. It's called the L'Affaire de Ravel.
Yeah.
And he was basically up for the prize, the French music prize, the Prix de Rome. And he was heavily favored to win after he had failed for many years to do so. And there was a huge public outcry when one of the panelists, the composers that was judging the Prix de Rome, only his students made the finals. So people were a little bit disappointed that Ravel did not move on from that.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into, I guess, the biographical information.
Right. Yeah, we already mentioned L'Affaire de Ravel, but it was kind of kicked off by his time at the Paris Conservatory, where he started at the age of 14, studying with Faure, who was a big influence of his. And he's at the time, Ravel is a great piano player. He's actually expelled from the university in 1895 because he fails to win any competition medals for 3 consecutive years. And that shows me, like, it's like Ravel was incredibly intelligent, and he could be a good student, but he wanted to go his own way. So he wasn't necessarily concerned with competing, as you shouldn't be with music. But he returns a couple years later, 3 years to be precise. He's expelled for a second time for the same reasons. He's focusing on his composition. He does not have time to win a prize. So his final return to the conservatory, this is when the scandal happens. And this is when Ravel does not win the Prix de Rome, even though he was favored. And so that is unfortunate. But we're moving on to later in his career, where after Debussy passes away, Ravel is considered to be the preeminent French composer at the time. And this scares him a little bit. And I think this letter he gets from Faure kind of cements this. Faure says, "I am happier than you imagine about the solid position which you occupy and which you have acquired so brilliantly and so rapidly. It is a source of joy and pride for your old professor." So nice words by Faure, but also that's got to be a lot of pressure for Ravel.
Right, and then, high standards.
Right. So and unfortunately, his mother passes away the same year, which makes him kind of fall into this depression, kind of decreases his output, as it would with anyone. He's even offered the French Legion of Honor, which is the equivalent of the American Medal of Honor in 1920, but he declines it. And so Satie is actually not too happy about this, and he's like, "Well, your music accepts it, but you don't." So that gives you an idea of Ravel there.
And some of the composers around him at the time.
Right, yeah, so that French group was kind of eclectic there, for sure. And so Debussy and Ravel actually had a pretty good relationship throughout the 1890s, and they took a lot of inspiration from each other in terms of composition. But the public kind of scrutinized this because they were like, "Oh, you're writing the same music, basically." So then Ravel and Debussy drifted away, and that relationship was never really rebuilt there. But definitely interesting to note. So I think perhaps the most interesting is that Ravel did not take on a lot of students because he believed composers would lose their voice as a composer if they studied with him. They would just start writing Ravel's music. When George Gershwin tried to study with him, he's quoted as saying, "It would probably cause him to write bad Ravel and lose his great gift of melody and spontaneity." So he really believed in composers finding their own way. Mm-hmm. And I think that I think there's some merit to that. And I think that is completely fair.
Most definitely. But he did take on a student that became very famous soon after him.
Probably more so famous in the eyes of music history, for sure.
Right. And that is Rafe Von Williams. So Von Williams was a student of Ravel for 3 months. And Ravel is said to have inspired him with his motto, "Complex, but not complicated."
Right, right.
But some other works by Ravel that we recommend and that we like and got him on this list: his Orchestration of Pictures at an Exhibition, which we've mentioned before.
Right.
And Bolero as well.
Yeah, Bolero is one that he's really popular for, but I don't feel like that actually is too representative of his style as a composer. I think it's kind of an outlier, to be honest.
I do think that it is representative of his orchestration abilities and his way of being academic in a way, because to the average listener it might be very boring, and very plain.
Yeah,
to hear
it,
the
it
same
is fairly
thing.
Repetitive.
So. Oh, extremely repetitive. And that's one that, you know, I wouldn't listen to as your first piece with Ravel.
Yeah, definitely because, go with the pictures at an exhibition for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, or another one that we might list later. But yeah, Bolero can be quite repetitive and not the most exciting piece. I think that one is more of an academic one. But if you do choose to listen to that one, do listen to the whole thing because...
Right.
The entire point of the piece is that it builds and builds and builds until the climax at the end.
Right, exactly. And I think that is really important, particularly with Ravel's music and with a lot of composers on this list. His piano concerto in D major for the left hand is also significant for being incredibly difficult.
Yes.
The piano concerto in G and a couple others is Rhapsody Espagnol, Daphne and Chloe.
La Valse.
La Valse. Yeah. I didn't even put La Valse
on. Yeah, we didn't
on
put that
here.
On here. Yeah.
Yeah. So La Valse is a great one. There's a great album, I think it's by Berlin, with the piano concerto in G and La Valse on there. So definitely check that out. And then string quartet in F major is one that's new for me. I think it's a good showcase of some of his isms, so to speak. And there's this impressionist kind of sound mixed with more Baroque and classical sounds. It's a really interesting work there that I just discovered recently. Because of his inclination for the piano, he had a lot of works for solo piano, as well as his orchestral, chamber music, stage, and choral outputs. All right. Well, Fernando, anything else?
No, I think we're good to move on to... my favorite composer, at least according to this list, but he usually is, Alexander Scriabin.
Right.
He's number 18 on the average list, number 1 on my personal list, and 42 on yours. He lived from 1871.
I regret that every day.
Yeah.
I would have definitely had him higher if I was more familiar with his works.
Yep. So Russian composer, lived from 1871 to 1915. And I put him in this kind of turn of the century period.
Right.
Not quite 20th century, not quite romantic, a little bit on the edgier side of romantic, I guess. So I'll get into some of why I really like Scriabin. Some of it I already discussed in the first episode. We talked about him a little bit in the outliers of each of our lists separately.
Right, yeah. So we wouldn't want to discuss in our first episode, not discuss Fernando's number one composer, right?
Right. So some of that is in the first episode. So check that out if you like. But to just recap it a little bit, I really just enjoy his fascinating biography and this mix of tonality and atonality that he presents in his works. It was a lot of his music was super innovative for the time period, and he had so many ambitious ideas for presenting music, and he had inclinations that were a little bit outside of music,
right.
Like his mysticism or his inclination in mysticism. And he also apparently... might have been synesthetic or had synesthesia.
Yeah,
but
this is argued about.
Yeah, quite a bit, but that's a debatable topic, but it's also just part of his interesting biography.
Yeah.
So let's hear a little bit about why you might like Scriabin.
Right. So I, for a lot of the same reasons that you do, and I, quite frankly, if I had listened to his symphonic writing sooner, besides his concerto in F sharp minor, then he definitely would have been in my top 20 or way, shape, or form. But yeah, just so unique in terms of his place in history, incredibly engrossing and passionate and just really colorful works. I really, really love Scriabin and have enjoyed learning about him. And I couldn't be more thankful to Fernando for exposing me to such a great composer. We were driving to Kentucky on the way back from, we were driving from Kentucky on the way back to, from the National Trumpet Competition, and he's like, have you listened to Scriabin's Piano Concerto in F-sharp minor? And I had listened to Prometheus before, and a couple other of his works, but then I listened to the first 2 minutes of this work and fell in love. I think that it's just one of the greatest works written for piano.
Mm-hmm. It is so, so beautiful, and unfortunately, I don't think that's what we're playing today.
No, but... unfortunately, we couldn't find a great recording of that.
But... yeah, but before we get into some of his works, let's talk about his biography a little bit.
Right.
Funny enough, he was born on Christmas Day. He was pretty shy and antisocial throughout his life.
Right. I think that is big when you look at his music, and I think it's reflected, because there's almost a loneliness to some of his music, right? This outcry to be heard, and that was a big part of Scriabin's childhood. He wanted the approval of adults and of the people around him. I think that is important to note. He also studied with the same piano teacher as Rachmaninoff growing up, and then they went to the Moscow Conservatory together. And they had quite the relationship, Scriabin and Rachmaninoff. Some view it as a little friendlier, some view it as a little bit more adversarial, but they're really two sides of the same coin. I think both are virtuosic in their writing and their performing, but Rachmaninoff was maybe a little bit more influenced by Tchaikovsky, and then Scriabin did not like Tchaikovsky's music, who was my number one composer, so that could be what turned me off. But I think there's more similarities between Scriabin and Tchaikovsky's music than maybe
he would have liked to admit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Especially in his like Second Symphony, we'll get into that. But Rachmaninoff is compared to composers like Mozart as being a prodigy. Scriabin is criminally underrated and overlooked in the eyes of history,
and I think that's in a large part due to him wanting to do something really different and unique,
right?
With
he was
a lot
written
of his works
for the time, particularly. Mm-hmm. Just based off of his influences of philosophers like Nietzsche, and then mysticism and synesthesia, like we've mentioned earlier, I think that those had a big influence, and I don't think we should really get into those today because we're definitely going to have to do a deep dive on Scriabin.
Yes, a lot of really great biographical information that we're just going to save for another time because, like I've said, Scriabin is my favorite composer, at least most of the time. So,
yeah. So we're going to take a listen to one of his piano works that we think is pretty indicative of Scriabin's style. Let's take a listen to one of his five preludes, the fifth one, Fier Bellicue.
Scriabin's fifth prelude out of a set of five for piano. Very, very indicative of Scriabin's style and his kind of hecticness and
right,
but also beauty at the same time. It has this beautiful characteristic of being a little bit frantic and a little bit hectic, but
completely
still
unpredictable.
Yeah, unpredictable, but still really, really gorgeous in a way that is almost like the human mind, where it's going all over the place, but you know that it's something beautiful, you know? It's almost inexplicable for me, at least. But
this is when I find my that I have something due tomorrow. I have a big paper due, and I haven't done any of it. And that's the hecticness that's going on in my brain. That's what this reminds me of a little
bit.
Right. Yeah, with Scriabin, I think that there's so much great variety in his career. We talked about his piano concerto in F-sharp minor, which is probably both of our favorite work by him.
Yeah.
Definitely mine. I love his Second Symphony in C minor as well. We also want to tell a fun story about his piano sonata number one in F minor. This is a story that any dedicated musician can take symphony from. Scriabin was very passionately driven to overpractice Franz Liszt's Don Juan fantasy and damaged his right hand doing so. He's a piano player. And doctors said he would never be able to play again after this. So this sonata was a cry of anguish against God and fate, leading him to compose this and other works that featured incredibly technical work for the left hand, particularly, before his right hand recovered. So the left hand stuff, I think, it just blows my mind looking at some of the stuff that he asks.
Absolutely. And when you say incredibly technical works for the left hand, they are incredibly technical works for the left hand. It is it is almost, it feels, or it looks like it's just not humanly possible.
Absolutely.
He has an entire Prelude and Nocturne only for the left hand, and that is one of the most gorgeous works by Scriabin, but also it's so technically demanding when you see it and know that it's only for the left hand. If you see it performed as well, it is amazing to watch one person just move their left hand across the keyboard and play really lyrical and fascinating music all over the keyboard from the bottom to the top.
And I think, isn't it standard practice where they hold their right hand like at their side and they just have their left hand going?
Right, and it looks a little goofy, but it
incredibly
almost
impressive.
Yeah, it adds to the impressiveness so much. So that is a really, a critical part of a lot of his works is that he did injure his right hand for a while, and that meant that his left hand was going to be doing most of the work.
Right. And so one last thing about Scriabin, I want to read this to the audience without any context. So this is a work that Scriabin was working on called Mysterium. The quote is, "There will not be a single spectator. All will be participants. The work requires special people, special artists, and a completely new culture. The cast of performers includes an orchestra, a large mixed choir, an instrument with visual effects, dancers, a procession, incense, and rhythmic textural articulation. The cathedral in which it will take place will not be of a single type of stone, but will continually change with the atmosphere and the motion of the Mysterium. This will be done with the aid of mists and lights, which will modify the architectural contours. The performance would occur in the Himalayas in India, then shortly after the end of the world, and the people of Earth will be replaced with a more advanced race." So, if you're wondering if that's the plot to a horror movie or a piece by Alexander Scriabin, at least one he planned to write, he never finished it before his untimely death. That kind of explains some of Scriabin's just eclecticness, right?
Right, and why he's so fascinating to me as well. You can actually hear a little bit of this work. It's called, I think, Prefatory Action from Mysterium, and
that's technically like the first movement.
Right, it technically would have been kind of the beginning, so you can hear a little bit of it. There are recordings out there, so
I don't think in this situation he necessarily had movements. I think it was a little bit more it was planned to be a little bit more organic.
right. But still a snippet of that work that if you're intrigued by that description.
I can't imagine who wouldn't be.
Right. If you're intrigued by that description, go ahead and check it out. Prefatory Action from Mysterium by Scriabin.
All right. Well, let's move on from Alexander Scriabin because we could talk about that all day. Let's move on to number 19, Edward Elgar. British composer.
Right, so Elgar, he lived from 1857 to 1934. You know, kind of a some might say he's a classical romanticist, but I'm kind of here to prove you wrong today. I think
That's a little bit more of my speed, that I think he's a little bit more of a classical romanticist,
but definitely lived in the romantic period. For Alex he was ranked 16th, and for myself 29th.
I'm kind of surprised at the difference there, because I do love Elgar a lot, but You've exposed me to a lot of great Elgar works in the past 2 weeks that I had never even heard of.
Right, and in doing my own research for this episode, that's where I've really come to find even more works by him. But I'll get right into why I like Elgar and why he made my list. He has very intelligent compositions, often with a particular lushness that comes from a lot of English composers.
Oh, yeah.
Can actually have a good bit of heft as well to a lot of his works when you get a little bit deeper into the music that
we
found recently.
The last 2 weeks, and it's been great.
Yeah. Recently discovering his cantatas and oratorios was like finding a hidden treasure for me, because I was unfamiliar with them until recently. And I also think it's really fascinating that the enigma to his variations have still not been solved. They remain unsolved.
It's a big practical joke.
Yeah. So that's
there
another.
There is no enigma. He's just like, oh, scholars are just going to drive themselves crazy trying to find this.
Right. Which might be. I mean, who knows? So that's another fun fact about Elgar that I really like. So
yeah, for sure. What,
it looks like you only have one sentence here about Elgar.
Right. And I think I put it pretty simply here, because I think that there are two words that come to mind when I think of Elgar. And it might seem a little bit trite to put it this way, but I say his music is elegant and has a lot of variety. I think that elegance and variety are the two terms I would use to describe Elgar's music. And like Fernando said, that English lushness, I think, is especially present in his more popular works. But as I've grown to discover in the last 2 weeks, there's works like his Kingdom and the Apostles that maybe start out sounding a little bit more like some of his British ancestors, like Purcell, but develop into this great tapestry of British sound that I think is really unique to Elgar. Different from Vaughan Williams in that sense, or Holst, I think that his music definitely stands apart in that way.
Right. So I think we should actually get to the biography before we go back to the discussion.
Right. I think that is important.
Yeah.
And Fernando, you take it away, because Fernando wrote about 5 or 6 pages on Elgar here. So
right. So we're trimming it down quite a bit. But let's start from when he was 10 years old. At 10, he composed music for a family play that he later reworked into sections of the Wand of Youth suites and Starlight Express.
That's so cool to me that he took something that he wrote that young and then he adapted it later and just showed some of his genius throughout. I mean, you don't need to be in your 30s and 40s to be in your prime as a composer. I mean, you might have written great melodies when you were 10.
Right, right. So at age 15, he actually starts working at a solicitor's office, but at 16, he leaves that business and becomes a freelance musician, and he remains as a freelance musician for the rest of his life, actually. Some fun things that he did, or a fun thing that he did while he was a freelance musician, he played the bassoon in a wind quintet. And I don't think most of these composers were bassoonists. I don't think most of them played the bassoon.
I think that explains so much of this to me, especially this next point where Elgar was he really did not like any form of the music business other than composing. He didn't want to conduct. He didn't want to teach.
The quote is that he looked at it like turning a grindstone with a dislocated shoulder. So like you said, he disliked any other work, really, in the music business or outside of the music business. He didn't want to do anything except compose.
Right, which is, I mean, even in the modern world, I mean, it's tough to just do one thing and specialize in one thing, because people want you to be well-rounded and do all these things. And Elgar could do these things, but he did not want to. He's like, oh man, I don't want to play the bassoon.
Yeah, well, he definitely wasn't a fan of teaching like privately or later as
right, similar
as
to
a professor.
Ravel, I guess, in that way.
Yeah. So the variations on an original theme, sometimes known as the Enigma variations, really brought him to national prominence. And they keep him in relevance today. He's still incredibly relevant for this work.
Right.
The arrangements for band exist, as well as the original orchestral version. And I'm sure that many, many people have heard this work.
Oh, yeah. You've heard some variation somewhere. I think the finale is particularly famous, as well as his Nimrod from that. You hear Nimrod a lot in marching band and drum corps particularly. So if you're familiar with either of those genres.
So the Enigma, actually, to these variations, which is just a secondary theme that runs through the whole work, that's not the principal theme that he's varying. Like we said, it's still unsolved. And Elgar says of this...
Unsolved, in quotes.
Right. Elgar says of this, "The enigma I will not explain. Its dark saying must be left unguessed. Further, through and over the whole set, another and larger theme goes, but is not played." So it's a kind of little, it's a hint, I guess, but the second tune here that he's talking about, it may or may not exist, but a lot of people have been looking for it. And like I've said before, nobody's convincingly found a solution to the enigma.
I think it's a practical joke.
I mean, it very well could be. But
I could see it. Elgar is just like, oh no, these jokers, they'll never find it.
Well, I think we'll have to save that for, we'll have to dive into that a little bit later.
Right. Right.
In a different episode, I think. we'll try to solve it ourselves. Who knows?
that's the Pepe Silvia, the Always Sunny, that shot. But anyway, so with Elgar, earlier I said that he was a little bit more of a classical romanticist. And I think that my opinion has been swayed slightly. It depends on which of his music you're looking at. Let's discuss some of these pieces here, because we have his variations on an original theme, the Enigma. I would say that borrows a lot from the classical style. But then Apostles and the Kingdom, I think, maybe show off a little bit more of a 20th century influence.
Yeah, a little bit. Those are both oratorios that would have been in a trilogy, except Elgar did not finish the third work in this,
right?
And what would have been a trilogy.
He also wrote three symphonies.
He did write three symphonies, yeah. And those are all a little bit later in his career. He had kind of put that off for a while. But three symphonies, and kind of in an unusual form a little bit. They start with a relatively slow movement. I think all three of them do.
Right.
I think for both of us, we were kind of listening to the oratorios.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of just started playing the symphonies after that.
And I didn't even realize.
Yeah. And it's kind of hard to realize. And not that the symphonies have vocalists, but they have a similar vibe and
right. You know, I thought it mood. Was like, I was like, oh, this is a nice interlude. And then I look at Spotify, I'm like, this is a different piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so those are also interesting and great to check out if you haven't heard them. He also has a violin concerto and a cello concerto that right. is very, very famous.
Right. I love his violin concerto. I think it's up there with Sibelius for me in mm-hmm. terms of one of my favorites.
And you might be familiar with Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance March, or marches, actually.
Yeah, there's four of them.
There's four of them, but you are only probably familiar with one of them. And that is played at graduation at most high schools, if not all high schools, across the U.S.
A lot of universities, too.
Yeah, and a lot of universities all over the U.S. Not sure about other countries, but it's very popular.
Right, for sure. And there's much more to these. Even the theme they use for graduation, I think, is so gorgeous and so beautiful. And people, especially in our profession, are like, oh, here we go, we got to play this. But I'm like, this is such beautiful music.
Right. Right. And there's so much more to those four marches. So a lot of music there by Elgar, and very worth the listen to if you want to get some context on where the graduation march comes from, or if you want to just branch out a little bit from right. that starting point.
And unfortunately, we also don't have any listening for Elgar today. Nothing that was quite up to our standard in terms of quality of recording.
But I'm sure you could imagine the graduation march in your head, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure half of you are singing it right now. So I guess if we don't have anything else on Elgar, we can go ahead and move on to our final composer for today.
Sure. Who do we have for number 20, the final composer for the day?
So this is a composer that I really have loved for a long time, but only for a couple of works. And then when I really started to dive into his music, I fell in love even more and might put him higher on my list. I think that he is one of the great Russian Romantic composers. And number 20 in our list is Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov. Like we said, Russian Romantic composer, 1844 to 1908. Ranked only number 26 on my list and 23 on Fernando's. I might have probably put him in the earlier teens, if I was able to redo this list after doing some research. But some really great programmatic works that are incredibly well orchestrated, technical, and easily digestible, I think, in terms of listening. I think that the way he presents his orchestration is incredibly digestible for any kind of listener. And that's why works like Scheherazade are incredibly popular. But we'll talk about some other less familiar works by him that you might enjoy as well.
And like you said, he has a lot of iconic works that are really well known, especially in the classical music community, orchestral community. And I think that those works really helped to establish this new Russian style that composers later would use in their own works and in their own style.
Right.
So I think that's really important. A lot of dramatic works from Rimsky-Korsakov with a lot of course, really great and clever orchestration, because that's what he's kind of known for.
Yeah, but in our studies. With that, it's interesting because he wasn't actually that educated.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think that that's important to note with Rimsky-Korsakov, that he was a Navy man. Right? I think that was his primary profession. He started at Naval College at age 12. His brother was in the Navy. That was a big influence on him. And then he meets Balakirev, who becomes one of his big influences, also a member of the famous Russian Five, which Rimsky-Korsakov becomes a part of, which included Balakirev, Rimsky-Korsakov, as well as Mussorgsky, Borodin, and Kui. All of them were not musicians by trade, necessarily.
Right.
And so Rimsky-Korsakov fit into that just as well. So for a while, he takes a couple of breaks in here. He takes a break for the Navy from his composition, in the middle of writing his first symphony. Then he comes back, finishes it, and then his career takes off. He becomes a professor at the St. Petersburg Conservatory, which causes a rift between him and the rest of the five because they didn't like the how institutionalized music education was becoming. They viewed it as a little bit more of a side thing, and like the beauty that can be found just from not necessarily being as academic through music, which has some merit. But Rimsky-Korsakov learned a lot at the university. He was actually quoted as saying when he got there, "Having undeservedly become a conservatory professor, I soon became one of its best students." And I think that this is great and why I identify with him so much, because he's really committing himself to being a lifelong learner, right? He's not like, oh, I'm arrived at St. Petersburg, I could just be a professor and be done. He's really committing himself. And then even for 2 years, at one point, he doesn't write anything but chorales and fugues in the style of Bach. That's mm-hmm. dedication right there. He's immersing himself into the academic side of his music, which with the exoticism of his early works and that combined, and his expanding knowledge on orchestration, he just becomes this juggernaut in terms of emotional and passionately driven music that's also quite academically sound as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most definitely. And I think him diving into those chorales and fugues, I think that really does show that he was really trying to learn to approach music more academically,
right?
Which is
a paradigm
different.
Shift. Yeah,
yeah, and it's very different from most composers that need to either do one or the other,
right?
Or balance them in a way. You know, I think he did that in an unusual way a little bit, to go into academic music later,
right?
And that caused him to revise a lot of his works.
That's
later
a big
as well.
Thing, right? Because a lot of the revisions are they take out some of the more exotic harmonies that you heard earlier on, or just expand upon the work a little bit. And I think that's interesting. He continued that process until he passes away. So a couple more facts about Rimsky-Korsakov. We already mentioned he was a famous part of the Russian Five. Mussorgsky, who was also a member of the Russian Five, was actually his best man at his wedding. So, and his wife was also a musician, worth noting there. Perhaps most famous in the academic world of music is his famous book, Principles of Orchestration, which is an incredibly detailed and interesting insight into the mind and the compositional process that he used. He even uses his own music examples and dives into the rationale behind some of those examples. So I think that's really interesting mm-hmm. to me. I mean, I haven't finished the read, but we'll definitely have to do an episode where we both read that and then we talk about it, because that'd be fun.
Yeah, that'd be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. So let's talk about his music. Let's do some listening. So this is a recording of his Russian Easter Festival Overture. This is about 4 minutes into the work, so don't go looking for this at the beginning of the work. Let's take a listen.
Thank you.
That was a recording of Rimsky-Korsakov's Russian Easter Festival Overture, around 4 minutes into that piece. So I think that this excerpt was really good. First of all, that opening with the bassoon, right, where we just open that up.
Yeah, how unusual for the time period.
Right, and especially for Russian composers. I feel like that is so out of the blue, and that's why we wanted to start right there, just to show you. And then it gets into, there's some complicated solo writing in the clarinet that it shows you how virtuostic some of the parts that he would write for solo instruments would be. But then there's this, there was almost this Latin type feel, yeah, in the string part.
Yeah, a little bit of syncopation to give it a groove.
Yeah, when you mentioned that, I was really, really surprised by that. And it just shows you how much influence he took from his early career, where he wasn't maybe as educated. He was just writing what sounded good to him.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think that there's something to be said for that, because some of his early works, like his first symphony, though it was revised, still has this really unique voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that trying to silence that completely, we would have lost a lot of great work. So definitely, even from the beginning of his career, maybe being a little less educated, to the end where he's the master of all aspects of academic music, creates a really cool voice for a composer, for sure. Let's talk about some of his other pieces that we recommend. His three symphonies, just like Elgar, that are incredibly underrated.
Yeah, not very well known, but very beautiful and very similar to a lot of his other music. So if you like what you hear, maybe if you like what you heard in this little excerpt, check those out.
Right, and then he has his famous trilogy of Scheherazade, Capriccio Espagnol, and Russian Easter Festival Overture, which we just listened to. Those three are regarded as being the peak of his orchestration and how strong of writing he had for all parts of the orchestra. Definitely really, really great works there. Scheherazade being the most well-known.
Yeah, and I think that orchestration is very clear. It's very obvious when you listen to Scheherazade,
yes,
or see it performed. It's very obvious in that way, but it's that is his best-known work and probably my favorite work by him.
Right, and I think my new favorite work by him is actually his Fantasia on Serbian Themes, which he wrote in 1867, which a little bit earlier on in his career, later edited in 1887, nearly 20 years later. Exactly 20 years later. So this is a really great showcase of his signature style. Tchaikovsky was a big fan of this one, so you can tell why I'm a big fan of it. Mm-hmm. It's very Tchaikovskyan in that way. So definitely worth checking out that one. There's a couple others. His Tale of Tsar Sultan, Milada, which his Procession of Nobles comes from. Oh, I didn't mention the Tale of Tsar Sultan is where the Flight of the Bumblebee comes from.
Right.
So another one of his famous works, which it blows my mind that that's one of his most well-known works, when that is just an interlude,
right,
of that much larger work.
It kind of shows where he lies in the period of music, right? Or the,
right,
the time of music, right? He's in the Romantic period, so that's a very programmatic it's a piece that is trying to represent something.
Exactly.
And so I guess that really helps to show that, and I think he does that that type of thing. He writes a lot of programmatic music and a lot of dramatic music, so I think it's in some way very typical of his work, but also a little bit overdone, a little bit overplayed.
Yeah, yeah. So. At least for my taste.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I like Flight of the Bumblebee, but I would much rather listen to some of the other the depth in the rest of that piece.
Yeah, same here.
So, yeah, I think Rimsky-Korsakov has a lot to offer. Definitely check out some more of him if you can. So, I think that about wraps things up. Thank you guys for listening today. Like we said, this is 11 through 20 of our top 100 composers. So each month we'll do another edition of this. And be sure to leave some recommendations in reviews if you review us on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you might be listening to us on. Definitely leave some suggestions, because we'd love to see what you guys would enjoy hearing from us. We're always open to new things. Not just in the orchestral realm. We've done episodes on jazz and musicals now. So we definitely want to branch out and do some more, though classical music in general is our background.
You might say it's our forte.
It's our forte. So yeah, I thank you guys for tuning in and listening today. And do you have anything else, Fernando?
Yeah, if you liked anything that you heard today, make sure to check those composers out. If you missed our first 10 composers, then check that out in episode 1. And just thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to the Leading Tone Podcast. You can email us at theleadingtonepodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can find us on social media at The Leading Tone Podcast with no spaces on Instagram and The Leading Tone Podcast on Facebook.
Thanks again, and tune in next Monday for more of The Leading Tone Podcast.